find the linchpin, really, for the whole ideology of Ish Halacha, and not only in this essay, but in throughout the Rav's works and his life work, and that is the idea that the Ish Halacha's perspective on reality is something that is shaped. Oh, did we forget to begin? Is something that is shaped by. You'll voice it in over afterwards. Yeah. Ooh, I would do it myself, but I don't even remember what I just said. whatever it is, I stand by it. I don't remember. The Ish Halacha's own perspective is something that is defined by, characterized by, you know, the halachic lens that he, you know, that he uses, you know, on history. And the idea that, you know, for him, halacha isn't just a, you know, a set of prescriptions and obligations, etc., but represents, you know, number one is raison d'etre, is the reason for being created. And in addition to that, it reflects a certain value system, which, you know, he internalizes, even as he, you know, externalizes the mitzvos themselves. And if this is the case, I'll just read you some of the passages in just a minute. So, in a sense, this greater, this more ambitious understanding of you know, the role of halacha and you know, its value as a system and what it's intended to accomplish as a system, right, ends up being the foundation for integrating transcendence, right, into the material world. In other words, what I'm suggesting is, you know, if you were to, again, we've been contrasting, you know, this view and that view, the Mesillas Yesharim and the Ish Halacha, but it would be a mistake for someone to walk away, you know, and to think that you know, the Ramchal, you know, is let's say negative, right? He views disapprovingly, right, the material world and physical pleasure, you know, and you know, sees it all as a trap to be avoided, right? One can, you know, attain, you know, the portal of you know, of Olam Haba in a pristine manner, you know, without having been sullied, you know, by the challenges of this world. So that's, you know, almost is an ideal kind of life, and that's what the halacha is trying to accomplish for him. It's his way of navigating around all of these temptations and michsholim. So it's, you know, again, a projection of a transcendent and by means of a more ascetic, you know, kind of a lifestyle, you know, a more spiritual focus. Whereas, let's say the, you know, the archetypes reflected, right, again, in the extreme, but, you know, that are then moderated and subtilized, if one can make a verb of it, in the Ish Halacha, you know, leave you with the impression that the material world, especially the Ish Halacha's perspective of the material world, never mind even the spillover into homo religiosus, is where all the action, spiritual action, really is, and that's because the material, there's nothing wrong with material existence, and pleasure has its role. We'll discuss that as well, whether it's in Machalos Asuros or in the Kedusha of Ishus, and other such things. So this is a more material view of the world, a less spiritually or exclusively spiritually, you know, focused one. That's the way it is. It's an embrace of the world as it exists, and some sort of, in some sense, a less spiritual perspective on the world. So that would just be completely inaccurate. Because this linchpin, which the Rav develops in this essay, Ish Halacha, in the English version, starting from mostly starting from page 17, right, is the Kosev Ashlishi, you know, Hamachria Beneya. It's what establishes what, from his point of view, is an even greater ambition and a, you know, a kind of a more profound extension of the notion of the spiritual life. In other words, it isn't just that the halacha infuses the material world, you know, with spirituality. It's that, but even more that, the perspective of the halacha, the values of the halacha, right, reorients our sense of reality itself. And therefore the world as other people perceive it is not the world that the Isha Halacha, again, this is an ideal, right, is engaged with and is integrated in. So that statements, the big statements, I say, the ones that seem exaggerated and dramatic, and they certainly are and they're intended to be, but they're meant to be followed up by nuances, the statements like, you know, the Isha Halacha turns his back on transcendence and so on, have to be reformulated to mean that, you know, by being given this capacity of applying halakha as a lens, as a framework, you know, with which to view and to live or to engage, right, the material world and reality, so not only are we adding, let's say, value to material life, but you're really, as say, reformulating it and transforming it completely. Now that is a far greater ambition, if you can pull it off, right, than simply avoiding minefields, even though there's room for both. So what do I mean by this? I'll just give you, you know, some of the classic formulations of page 17, beginning page 17. Halakhic man differs in his worldview from the universal homo religiosus. He resembles in various ways cognitive man, yet he differs in many respects from him as well. So halakhic man's approach to reality is at the outset devoid of any element of transcendence. That's the big sentence that I mentioned before. Indeed, his entire attitude to the world stands out by virtue of its originality and uniqueness. All of the frames of reference constructed by the philosophers and psychologists of religion for explaining the varieties of religious experience cannot accommodate halakhic man as far as his reaction to empirical reality is concerned. So that's a lot. You can already see what's happening here. You start off with a dramatic statement, which sounds like a rejection of transcendence, right? The rejection of transcendence is like a rejection of spirituality, right? If you stop right there, right? But what, you know, the Rav is then developing is that the halachic man, by virtue of the framework of halacha, has a unique, right, sense of reality. He's just, his orientation is totally different, and it defies any kind of parallel characterization. Now, if the point was that, you know, the material world is, you know, per se something that is spiritually advantageous, that doesn't defy, you know, any kind of analogy. And this part is, again, dramatically written, but accurately written to what's following. Halachic man studies reality not because he is motivated by plain curiosity, the way a theoretical man is, nor is he driven to explore the world by any fear of being or anxiety of non-being, nor for that matter does halachic man orient himself to the world in terms of a nebulous feeling of absolute dependence or yearning for the redemption of man or the visions of great revealed ethical ideal. Halachic man orients himself to reality through a priori images of the world which he bears in the deep recesses of his personality. This is the what I call the Kosov HaShlishi HaMachriya. Namely, this sense of halachic reality, this lens, which, you know, he's looking at the same thing that, you know, a cognitive man or a religious man is looking at. Cognitive man who embraces it, betoras what it is, and religious man who, if he doesn't reject it, but at least, you know, feels that he has to partially extricate himself from it, but he's seeing something different, right, from both. We may, if we desire, call this a cognitive normative approach. And that's exactly a good way to express it, right? It's a cognitive approach, but slash, it's a hyphenated cognitive normative approach. One which is driven, right, from without, not something that flows from man's own originality or his own instinct, but which is imposed upon him by the Tzivui Hashem. But it is not to be identified with the cognitive and ethical orientation which philosophers, the cognitive men, par excellence, speak. We know that cognitive man has a dual relationship to reality, an empirical a posteriori approach and an a priori approach. And it need not be emphasized, the entire dispute between rationalists and empiricists centers around this problem. In truth, this disagreement symbolizes two different directions in man's relationship to reality. When cognitive man scrutinizes God's world and seeks through critical probing to determine its nature, he arrives at two different decisions. To plunge into the very midst of reality and contemplate its appearance in order to understand its essence and structure. Right, that's what cognitive man does. I'm skipping a little bit. He gropes in the darkness, is astonished and amazed by the plethora of phenomena, by chaos and void, and so on. The second, in order to overcome the mystery in existence, he constructs an ideal, ordered, fixed world, one that is perfectly clear and lucid, fashioning an a priori ideal creation with which he is greatly pleased. This creation does not cause him any anxiety, etc. But what he's trying to suggest is that the Ish HaLacha, right, takes of neither of these extreme approaches. Instead, he is given a directed, right, perspective. That's what Torah Misinai is. That's what Taryag Mitzvos are. And by mechanism of, I'm adding, just supplementing a little bit, by the mechanism of Talmud Torah and the values of Halakha, right, he's given a he's given an approach, right, to reality. That too is a kind of a priori mechanism, but the a priori mechanism is one which is given by Masorah. That's why, starting from page 19, when Halachic man approaches, there are some of the most famous passages of Ish HaLacha, when Halachic man approaches reality, he comes with his Torah given to him from Sinai in hand. He orients himself to the world by means of fixed statutes and firm principles. An entire corpus of precepts and laws guide him along the path leading to existence. Halachic man, well furnished with rules, judgments, fundamental principles, draws near the world with an a priori relation. His approach begins with the ideal creation and concludes with the real one. To whom may he be compared? To a mathematician. This is something that the Rebbe speaks about in other of his writings, including Mado Dech Midot, his Hesped of Rav Elbel. Right? He has different formulations in different places, but to a mathematician who fashions an ideal world, then uses it for the purpose of establishing a relationship between it and the real world, as it was explained above. The essence of Halacha, which was received from God, consists in creating an ideal world, cognizing the relationships, the relationship between the ideal world and our concrete environment in all of its visible manifestation, underlying structures. There is no phenomenon, entity, or object in this concrete world which the a priori halacha does not approach with its ideal standard. When halachic man comes across a spring, bubbling quietly, he already possesses a fixed a priori relationship with this real phenomenon. The complex laws regarding the halachic construct of a spring, of course, say a mayim. The spring is fit for immersion of a zav. It may serve as mechatas. It purifies with flowing water, right? It does not require a fixed quantity of arbaim sa. When a halachic man approaches a real spring, he gazes at it and carefully examines its nature. He possesses an a priori ideal principles and precepts to establish the character of the spring as a halachic construct, and he uses the statutes, for the purpose of determining normative law. Does this real spring correspond to the requirements of the ideal halacha or not? Halachic man is not overly curious, and he's not particularly concerned with cognizing the spring as it is in itself. Rather, he desires to coordinate the a priori concept with the a posteriori phenomenon. Thus, he's applying, right, these ideal constructs to the real world, which he senses and which he materially encounters. When halachic man looks to the western horizon and sees the fading rays of the sun, setting sun to the eastern horizon and sees the first light of dawn and the glowing rays of rising sun, he knows that his sunset or sunrise imposes upon him anew obligations and commandments. Dawn and sunrise obligate him to fulfill those commandments that are performed during the day. Recitation of the morning Shema, Tzitzis, Tfilin, Esrog, Shofar, Hallel, and the like. They make the time fit for carrying out of certain halachic practices. Temple service, acceptance of testimony, conversion, chalitza, like what's the shem yom for this, what's the shem yom for that, this doesn't talk about here, but right, all the lumdus of, you know, there's yom, there's hafkaas laila, there's bein hashmashos, right, for various things, all of these represent part of those constructs, and so on. The sunset on Sabbath and holiday, eves, right, sanctify the day, kedushas hayom, the profane and the holy are dependent upon a natural cosmic phenomenon, the sun sinking below the horizon. Not anything transcendent that creates holiness, but the visible reality, the regular cycle of the natural order. Halachic man examines the sunrise, the sunset, the dawn, the appearance of the star, he gazes into the horizon. Is the upper horizon pale, the same as the lower, right? The shiurim for you know, ben hashmashos and shkia and tseis, and so on. Has afternoon already arrived? When he goes out on a clear moonlit night, he makes a blessing upon it, and so on. When halachic man chances upon a mighty mountain, he utilizes the measurement which determined a private domain, right, Rosh Hashayachid. You get the general idea. And this goes on for several pages. Halachic man explores every nook and cranny of the physical biological existence. He determines the character of all the animal functions of man, right, and so on, by means of halachic principles and standards, the bulk of an olive, kezias, right, koseves, kedechilas pras, revius, and so on. I'm skipping again. There's no real phenomenon to which halachic man does not possess a fixed relationship from the outset and a clear, definitive, a priori orientation. He's interested in sociological creations, the state, society, the relationship of individuals within a communal context. Halacha encompasses laws of business, torts, neighbors, plaintiff, defendant, creditor, debtor, partners, agents, right, shuftim, shlichim, right, umnin, I'm translating a little bit, shomrim, right, family life, marriage, divorce, chalitza, sota, conjugal refusal, miun, the respective rights, obligations, and duties of a husband and a wife, is clarified and elucidated, war, the high court, courts, penalties, all are just a few of the multitude of halachic subjects. The halachist is involved with psychological problems, sanity and insanity, possible or impossibility of a happy marriage, migo, right, a plea that gains credibility. Halacha has a fixed and a priori relationship to the whole of reality in all of its fine and detailed particulars. Halachic man orients himself to the entire cosmos and tries to understand it by utilizing an ideal world which he bears in his halachic consciousness. All halachic concepts are a priori, and it is through them halachic man looks at the world. As we said, his worldview is similar to that of the mathematician, a priori and ideal. Both the mathematician and halachist gaze at the concrete world from an a priori ideal standpoint, using a priori categories and concepts which determine from the outset their relationship to the qualitative phenomena they encounter, and so on. When many halachic concepts do not correspond with the phenomenon of the real world, halachic man is not at all distressed. This is the Rav's famous discussion of drosh v'kabel schar. Right? Should we be disturbed by when the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, you know, that Yirani dachas lahayev la nivra, or you know, ben sorer morer lahayev la nivra, right? What does it mean when we say drosh v'kabel schar? So his suggestion is, it doesn't mean, you know, this is a way to build up your credit rating, you know, on your permanent record. What it really means is that the concept of Yirani dachas, the concept of ben sorer more, right, as categories, as ideas, you know, shiurim in you know, mamrim, you know, and mered and avodah zara, etc., right, the values are no less powerful, right, even if there never was nor ever could there be such a case. And Kal v'chomer b'benosh of Kal v'chomer goes on to discuss the fact that, you know, Beis Shammai's alongside Beis Hillel's and Kodshim Taros and Zroim Bizmanenu alongside of, you know, Nashim and Nezikin and Moed. Now it's the ability to implement the halacha Lamaisa is of secondary importance to the concepts and the categories themselves. Even discusses the role of psak halacha. The foundation of foundations and the pillar of halachic thought is not the practical ruling, but the determination of the theoretical halacha. Therefore, many of the greatest halachic men avoided and still avoid serving in rabbinical posts. They rather join themselves to the group of those who are reluctant to render practical decisions. And if necessity, which is not to be decried, also an important perspective, compels them to disregard their preference and to render practical decisions, this is only a small, insignificant responsibility. That's, again, a particular perspective which not everybody would adopt, but which is typical of Brisk, which does not stand at the center of their concerns. The theoretical halacha, not the practical decision, the ideal creation, not the empirical one, represents the longing of halachic man. Halachic man engages in theoretical discussion and debate concerning subject of sacrifices. Purity plumbs the depths of these concept laws, distinctions with the same seriousness. He investigates and searches out the laws of aguna, plaintiff, defendant, forbidden food, etc. So basically what I'm trying to establish is I think this, the structure of this essay is, you know, it's just very fascinating. The Rav starts with the, you know, the two extreme archetypes, as we've just discussed, and they are formulated initially extremely, and as he, you know, continues the process, this is what they represent, and of course, there's a more moderate, you know, range, number one. Moreover, even the extremist, you know, archetype, you know, expresses itself in more moderate aspects. And then you have, you know, the Isha Halacha, which is the Kasav HaShlishi HaMakriya Beneyam, and he's not, of course, just, you know, the midpoint between the two, especially since the, you know, even the religious man is somebody who has an interest, you know, in the world. But the mechanism, right, which establishes not only the legitimacy, but more importantly, the ambition or the idealism of this idea, so that, as I stated before, it's not in contrast to other systems, it's not a compromise, like, oh, the physical world, the material world, you know, that also, you know, is of religious significance. As if that's some sort of a compromise or a concession. On the contrary, it's exactly the opposite. It's then comes this whole section developing the idea that one can relate to material world, right, by means of the fixed, what he calls the a priori, right, framework of the halacha, right, that ambition, the idea that you're taking, you know, a physical world which is normally, you know, perceived in a certain way and related to or engaged in a certain way, and that somehow your status as a mitzvah and your commitment to the system of revealed halacha, right, that somehow that can transform the way that you look at and actually integrate into the physical and material world. So that's not just the transformation, it's not just the suffusion of Kedusha and Tichol, it's really much more than that. It's even much more ambitious than that. Of course, it has to have a very strong abstract framework type component, because otherwise the whole thing doesn't work. That's why you get, you know, all of these paragraphs, you know, analyzing, you know, a just, you know, giving you a glimpse into how, you know, you can be looking at or orienting towards reality in a very different way, right? If you're steeped and immersed, you know, in the categories of halacha, and that's why it's equally important, right, to emphasize, you know, the role of the abstract and the theoretical, right, alongside the obligation of you know lilmod amanas lekayim, lilmod amanas lasos. Yeah.
Forgive me if I was going to speak on this later, but I was wondering how this fits in with what he says later, where he talks about how the point is to, as opposed to homo religiosus, who wants to go up to the hechro elonim, he wants to bring, like,
no, that's exactly the point, right? Exactly the point is that that you don't need, this is the next point I was about to get to. So again, we'll stop in one more minute, but let me just, if you go to page 30, I guess, but the point I'm trying to make is that this is a more ambitious approach, not a less spiritual one. It's a different perspective towards spirituality. I say it's one that requires enormous immersion and study and emunah, right, in a very inspirational way. But the result of that is, so then you get to page 30, which is, I think, what Kelly is referring to, or beginning page 30. Halachic man's relationship to transcendence differs from that of universal homo religiosus. Halachic man does not long for transcendent world, for supernal levels of a pure, pristine existence, for was not the ideal world halachic man's deepest desire, his darling child created only for the purpose of being actualized in our real world?
So it my is, question is just why isn't Sa'at really the greatest opportunity to bring...
No, it is. So again, that's why he has...
So I was basically asking, what does he mean by Sa'at not being important?
Because he doesn't say Sa'at is not important. What he really says is...
By force, enforcing Sa'at, I mean, Frisker should want to do Sa'at more than anyone else because they get to carry the ideal halacha.
Well, so that I think that's what why he has the line, which I read before, which is, I think he's trying to explain two different things. I think he's trying to explain the psychology of a certain Talmidei Chachamim, and why it is that they were more reticent to be penned in, let's say, to Psak Halacha. I think that's really what he's describing. It's more like a psychological attitude, and that's why he has the line at the same time, which I think I did read, or at least I intended to read. I think I did. The one about... one second. He has a line where he says, and if necessity, which is not to be decried, right, compels them, this is on page 24, and if necessity, which is not to be decried, compels them to disregard their preference and to render practical decisions, right? Now, what does that mean, not to be decried? Meaning, of course, the idea that I tried to cover it very quickly, but I'm glad you asked so I can elaborate on it. You know, no one can turn their back on Lilmod, Almanas, Lasos, right? I always like to quote the... I'll stop in a minute, but I always like to quote the Rishonim, especially some of the Chachmei Provence, the Meiri in a bunch of places, when they try to explain why there's no din of Osek Mitzvah, Patur Min HaMitzvah, you know, when it comes to Talmud Torah, right? I mean, the Rambam actually in Hilchos Ishus, that does seem to apply a kind of Osek Mitzvah, Patur Min HaMitzvah, at least in theory, to Talmud Torah, as does the famous Tshuva of the Maracha or Zerua. But mostly, right, we say Yikarehi Mipninim, Kol Chafatzecha Lo Yishvuba, right? And normally, we also say at the same time that it's a mitzvah Sheyefshar Lasos HaYidei Acherim, right? Then it's Docha Talmud Torah. So how do we explain that? So the Meiri basically has a line in a few places in Chagiga and Moed Katan where he says that if we wouldn't say that, then your learning would be Lilmod, right, Shalom Manas, Lasos, and that would be a chisaron in your learning as well. So there's something like that underlies this mentality. In other words, of course there's Lilmod Amanas. If there's the opportunity of Lasos, then it's part of the Asuke Shmaitz Alib and Hilchasa, right, includes knowing the actual Psak. Well, Rav was explaining that Ben Sora Morer or Irani Dachas, Lahoyev El Nivra, Drosh Kabel Skar, and he wasn't saying, it's just nice to learn the Sugya, or learning the Sugya is all that matters. You're also supposed to come to a conclusion. Let's say there's a Irani Dachas issue, right? It's important to figure out how we paskin on an Irani Dachas issue. I mean, should the Rambam render Piskei Halach on Irani Dachas, even if it turns out that it's Lahoya Velo Nivra, right? So the Ish Halacha would say, absolutely, there's no less reason to come up with a single psak, best psak Halacha, according to your conviction in the Sugya, in the case of Irani Dachas or Ben Sora Mora, than there is in a Hilchas Shabbos question or a Taras HaMishpacha question, you know, which is of consequence, practical consequence, every single day. Why? Because that process is still important. There still is a more ideal psak, and that reflects on the values. Moreover, no one would ever tell you, you know, that in a context of need, right, and that's b'makom sheinish, and that's what that half line that I mentioned before is, one shouldn't decry it, meaning if you're the one, you know, who should be rendering piskei halacha, then not to do so would be lilmod shalom anas lasos. Moreover, and this is where your ha'ara is a very important one, it's not just that it would be a chisaron in the theoretical, you know, Talmud Torah, right? It would be inconsistent with this whole vision, right, of an a priori, lumdus-centered, like, system, right, which is intended to be implemented in the concrete world. That actual implementation, the actual lasos, not just the lilmod amanas lasos, is key to man's purpose. Right? That's what he's for. What he's trying to describe, however, is, and I think again a little bit of historical context is important, and that is, you know, this very abstract perspective is not the typical one. It's the atypical one. Right? It may represent Lita, a Lithuanian approach, but it's not the one, that most people are accustomed to. So, Kedarko, the Rav is taking taking it a little bit more in the extreme. So what he's saying is, while all these things are true, right, the abstract discussion or the abstract psak that will never be implemented, either because there's no kodshim b'zman hazeh, or because ben sorer mor is lahoy v'lo nibra, right, the orientation of the isha halacha, right, is to be no less excited, right, about that discussion than the Taras HaMishpacha or the Shabbos one. Just that, in the Shabbos and Taras HaMishpacha one, b'makom shein ish, if he's the best person to paskin, then of course he has to, notwithstanding his reticence. So it's both of these elements, but the point is that he's trying to build up the case for theory and abstractness as representing a value structure, right, which is what this whole reorientation of reality is all about. So your point is well taken, but in terms of the first part of your question, that's not a problem. That's exactly the point. So the formulation that begins on page 30 and continues to later on, again, well, maybe I guess we'll at least have one more week of this, we'll discuss it later, but the idea of, you know, the Isha Halacha, you know, not to looking to escape the world, but to bring the world, you know, to bring the heavens down to the earth, if you will, is exactly consistent with this idea, because the system of Isha Halacha has basically transformed material reality, right, into a physical yet purely spiritual world. And that's a greater ambition. And that's Yafa, which I didn't get to today yet, but again, when we spoke about the Ramchal, especially last year, so one of the things I tried to emphasize was that the Ramchal assiduously avoids quoting the Mishnah in Avos, right? Yafa Sha'achas, you know, Ba'olam Hazeh Yoser, right? Mikol Chai Olam Haba. And that's Dafka, I think I read that passage last year. That's Dafka what the Rav calls, being that Mishnah, the watchword of the Isha Halacha. The idea that action, the real world, is the physical world. And that, you know, that's when he starts telling stories, and we'll read next time about the Gaon of Vilna, you know, the famous, Dalad Minim story of the Gaon of Vilna that everybody, you know, heard when they were young, about how the Gaon of Vilna had trouble one year procuring the Dalad Minim. I heard the story about the Esrog. I think the Rav tells the story about a Hadassah. Maybe it was two different years, I don't know. But, and then finally, you know, there was this one little lady or something, or this one person who had the min in question, whichever one it was, and, they said, but they're only going to give it to the gra, you know, under one condition, and that is that the schar, hamitzvah, accrues to them, and not to the gra. They're, like, very nervous whether he was going to accept this condition. So they tell this story. He tells the story in Isha Halacha, too. It's about the hadas, that, you know, the gra was, like, that was the happiest, you know, sukkahs, you know, that he ever had, because he said, here I'm doing this mitzvah, you know, and it's not confused in any way, you know, with the idea of skar, you know, olam haba. So that's a very, you know, Lithuanian, you know, perspective. And you know, they say that the gra died on Simchas Torah, and they have this song, you know, that Reb Chaim Volozhin supposedly made up. So the way the song goes, how does the Yiddish go again? You know, yeah, how does it go? Olam haba is a guta zach. How's it go? Olam haba is a guta zach. Is a besser zach.
Olam haba is a guta zach.
But every time we sing it at home, and we sing it, we always knock off the first olam haba and the last olam haba and replace it with learning Torah is a guta zach. Learning Torah is the best zach.
There you go. Okay. But the point is.
That one gets a little confusing.
Right. So I mean, is that the kind of song that the Ramchal would have sung? I don't know. Right. I mean, but that's like, it captures it a little bit. Meaning, and there are a few stories like that about the Gra, right? The Gra and the Magid. The Magid who offered to teach him, in his dreams, and he said, thank you so much, but no, thank you. That's the idea that Yafa Sha'achas Ba'olam Hazeh. The idea that Olam Haba, of course, is it's a good tzach, right? But the point is that, and the Rav has this also. I'll read the passage next time. It's schar, right? But schar is not to be confused with, you know, the world of avoda. It's not avoda, it's schar. It's the result of a lifetime of achievement, spiritual achievement. That takes place in this world. But again, as the Rav understands it, with a transformed orientation, you know, when you see the babbling brook and you're thinking of mikvos. I'm not saying you can't also say Marab Masach HaHashem.
Right.
But the point is you're not only saying that, right? And part of what you're appreciating it for, you know, is its Ish Halacha. Okay, we'll stop here and we'll continue with this.
I don't know if you're not going to...